Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Did you know that it's 50 years this week since Richard Nixon became the first US president in history to resign from office? To mark this monumental moment, Witness History brings you five programmes about influential events in US presidential history. And with all the amazing twists and turns in the current race for the White House, what a time to bring you them. You'll hear about the closest US election in history and from the man who was in the Situation Room during the raid on Osama bin Laden. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It was beautiful every morning. I woke up, had my breakfast, then went to school. It was really beautiful that you go to a place for learning and you make good friends. I had a really, really good friends, and still, sometimes I do see them in my dreams.
And what is it for girls now?
Everything is there for only boys, not for girls.
In August 2021, the Taliban seized the Afghan capital, Kabul, following the departure of US-led coalition forces. The group that led an insurgency for 20 years is now once again in power, this time ruling over the whole of Afghanistan. The consequences for women have been profound.
Some women are saying that even we are not allowed to breathe. Everything is dark, uncertain, complicated. The life is like a prison at homes. No identity, no work, no studies.
And here's how the Taliban see it.
Women. Women are not complete part of our economy. So if they will sit 50% of our population, if they will sit in home, so the next 50% will take care of them. This is our duty as a man.
In this episode, we'll try to understand the historical and cultural context of women's place in the Taliban's world order. Some UN figures want the group's erasure of women from public life to be recognized as gender apartheid, with women's agency and freedom destroyed. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Crassie Twigg, and this is the Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring, where we look at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda, and the disinformation.
Radio Tehran.
Мы не вторгались на территорию Украины.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
조중 두 당 두 나라 최고 영도자 동지들께서는
To give you an idea of the Taliban's preoccupation with women, the group issued nearly 100 edicts since returning to power, more than half of them targeting women. Here's a taste of what women are not allowed to do, voiced by BBC Pashto presenter Sana Safi.
First, the Taliban went after education by introducing gender segregation and banning girls from secondary schools beyond grade 6. A year later, the ban was extended to universities as well. Those lucky enough to have finished their university course could no longer receive their certificates. Next was work. First, women were banned from working in offices. Then they were gradually stopped from doing most jobs, like work in bakeries, restaurants, beauty salons. Women were then told not to leave their homes and instead send their male relatives to stand in for them at their workplace. A year later came a ban that prevented women from working for NGOs and for the UN. Given the country's reliance on foreign aid, this has had a major impact on the society. On the rare occasion of having a legitimate reason, in the eyes of the Taliban, to leave their homes, women were banned from using public transport alone or travel abroad without a mahram or male custodian. Women could no longer be issued with driving licenses either. In a country with one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, a woman nowadays cannot travel more than 70 kilometres without a male chaperone, even for health reasons. There are reports that women are not allowed to buy contraception. Basic hygiene has become a challenge by a ban on visiting public baths. Even parks and gyms are off limits if you're a woman in Afghanistan.
These draconian measures had been expected. The Taliban had ruled the country in the 90s, and people were familiar with their ways. Many urban professionals who enjoyed the freedoms brought by the international forces felt they had to leave the country. Among them was BBC journalist Shazia Haya. In London, she found a new purpose to her work, bringing women's voices on air.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, titles.
Since 2022, I've been producing a program called Women in Pashto with Mirman. Mirman means women. Every week I interview Afghan women in Afghanistan and outside. I'm talking about issues which are related to women, taboo issues about women's rights and everything.
Thank you.
I don't have enough words to describe how do women feel about themselves and about their life now in Afghanistan. The situation is really dark and uncertain. It's painful. The life is like a prison.
Isolation as well.
Absolute isolation. If you want to meet a friend, then you're not allowed to go there by taxi because in every stop or a checkpoint, you will be asked that why you're alone. Where is your male family member? Your father, your adult son, your brother, your husband, that could be a chaperone. Even if you're with your cousin, you will be asked that why you're with your cousin. Maybe he's not your cousin. If you know that you will be stopped 10 times, you will be questioned 10 times. Will you dare to go somewhere?
So it works.
Yeah, it works. Of course it works. Your family members will blame you. And how many times you want to that your family members will be involved in that risk? Taliban will come to your address and they will be questioned. Even they will be in prison. So will you be ready to take those risks?
The other project Shazia is involved with is DARS, which aims to fill some of the education gap created by the Taliban.
Salamuna. The BBC Dars Takhar Aghlast is a Shazia Hayayam.
Dars means lesson. It's a BBC educational program for Afghan children, including girls aged between 11 and 16, that they are not allowed to go to schools or they don't have access for education in Afghanistan.
What kind of feedback do you get from them?
One girl told us that Dars is like a light at the end of a dark tunnel. They are saying that please provide or produce more lessons. Everyone is getting benefit, even parents. They sit and they want to learn. So that is for children. And now I can say that including their parents as well.
What do the Taliban make of your programs?
They haven't said anything about Dars educational program.
When the Taliban banned female students from universities, a whole generation wept. And it's not just women who were left heartbroken. This male TV presenter couldn't hold back his tears. The Taliban's education policies haven't just affected schooling for girls. Observers have noticed strident efforts to mold the next generation of men. Harun Rahmani is watching the group from London. He too, like Shazia, left Kabul 3 years ago.
The Taliban are a fundamental religious and tribal group. First, they emerged in the southern province of Kandahar during the civil war in 1994. And within 2 years, they managed to capture Kabul and a large swath of the country. The Taliban are the graduates of the madrasas from the tribal areas of Pakistan. And they think that it was the graduates of these madrasas who helped them fought the U.S. get the country liberated. They have repurposed and turned most of the educational buildings, schools, and some of the bases which were used by U.S. and its allies to madrasas. And they also allocate more funds for madrasa than a school. And the reason is clear. They owe their success and victory to the students of the madrasas. And there is a kind of prioritizing and preference of religious education to modern.
Do they not think the country will need engineers and doctors?
There is no way they do not pay any attention to such critics. And especially in terms of the medicine, there is a need for women.
Harun picked up on an unconfirmed report about a curious subject in the madrasa curriculum.
There were a report by one of the media outlets, which is based outside Afghanistan, that they've included subject in the madrasa's curriculum, which was somehow convincing and encouraging women to get married with the Taliban fighters because they are better than the others.
The current leaders of Afghanistan were educated in madrasas, so religion is fundamental to them. But it's not all. To understand how the Taliban see their place in the world, our next expert, Bari Sadid, will take us on a deep dive into the historical context later. But first, his take on the Taliban.
The main thing that the Taliban represent now is that they control 100% of Afghanistan's territory. And that is a feat that has not been achieved since 1978. It is very much a social movement that came from Afghanistan's traumatized political history and has now effectively established itself as the one unifying power over Afghanistan's territory.
What is next on their agenda?
I would say maintaining unity and taking steps towards international recognition without compromising on what they see as their core Islamic values.
Their leader is now Hibatullah Akhundzada, who has an extreme and fundamental view of the Islam. And he is the one who has also in control of all affairs of the Taliban Emirate. And he is the only decision maker among the Taliban.
And what can we tell about him from his appearances, from the way he talks? Do we know much about him?
Yeah, he has not appeared in the media, and that's difficult to talk about how he looks like. But he has delivered speeches on different occasions, especially during the Eid prayers as well.
Hebatullah Akhundzada has an air of mystery about him. Some people have even doubted his existence.
Over the past years, we have listened to his speeches, and he is the same guy, actually. We know that someone is there in the name of Hibatullah Akhundzada, and there is also very, we can say, extremist or fundamental figures around him as well. But he is a spiritual leader, and since their return to power, he has been also accused by his critics of gradually monopolizing the power, the revenue sources of the country, especially the armed forces. And also he has, as some of his critics and some of the Taliban also talk about it, his own guard. He is based in Kandahar, and that's why sometimes the people say that there is a kind of division between Taliban who are in Kabul and the Taliban who are in Kandahar.
Would you say this is a similar situation to what we have in Iran?
Yeah, to a large extent, it looks like that. As the supreme leader of the Taliban, he is in charge of everything in the country.
And where do the Taliban stand after 3 years in power?
Everyone in the top leadership of all ministries and organizations are mullahs or religious scholars who have fought the U.S. and the Afghan government over the past 20 years. And there is no room for other people outside the Taliban movement to be appointed as the head of ministry. Over the past 3 years, no country has recognized them because all of them have their own demands for an inclusive government, and they want the Taliban to soften their stance on women's rights as well.
But it sounds like they're not prepared to budge on the issue of women.
They say that they are committed to ensuring the rights of women in Afghanistan, and they say that women in the other countries do not have their freedoms, and they are being used as a tool. They say if women have the freedom of mingling with men, this will cause a kind of moral corruption in the society. That's why they should stay at home all the time.
How are they explaining that with ideology?
Some of them say that it's an internal affairs, and some of them say that it is not only a religious issue, but also a cultural one.
This sounds similar to other deeply conservative societies. And it is this cultural context the Taliban lean on in their quest for acceptance.
There is a proverb in Pashto especially which says, a woman is either for home or grave. It means once a girl is born, she should stay under her parents' protection. And once she gets married, she should stay in her husband's home. And once she passes away, she should go to the grave. They say that women do not need to work, actually. It is the responsibility of a male member of a family to provide subsistence for women. And it is only women's consent before marriage, a widow's consent before remarriage, and also their right to inheritance. These are some of the things that the Taliban, especially their top leadership, are insisting that, see, we are the government that are actually committed to the women's rights.
So the Taliban's narrative is that it's all in the name of protecting women, as this direct quote from an edict puts it.
The leadership of the Islamic Emirate instructs all officials, religious scholars, and tribal elders to work hard to achieve these rights for women.
The message has been crafted, but how does it get disseminated? In the case of the Taliban, this bit is particularly revealing. And here's another quote we voiced up.
All Islamic Emirate officials should seriously advise their staff members to never publish leadership decrees and official and confidential documents on social media.
They are very, very cautious about their edicts, which are a little bit controversial. So they are not announcing it publicly. They are only ordering the relevant organization to implement the edicts. And sometimes these edicts, which are restricting especially women's rights, are leaked by the media outlets. But some of the edicts and also decrees which are not controversial are available on the website and the official gazette as well.
That's interesting. What does that tell you about the Taliban?
It shows the Taliban policy of gradually restrict women and not to draw criticism from the international community and the Afghan diaspora as well.
Here's what an uncontroversial edict sounds like.
The consent of an adult woman is necessary for nikah or marriage. A woman is not a piece of property, but a genuine human being. No one can trade her for peace in a marriage to assuage a blood feud. Those with multiple wives are obliged to give their wives their rights according to Sharia and to observe fairness among them.
Barry takes Haroon's argument further, explaining the Taliban's reticence to spell out the severe restriction on women with a dose of pragmatism.
It's interesting what's explicit and what's not. Even in the 90s, it was always this game of our infrastructure's been decimated, therefore we just need more time to establish a curriculum. And it's very much the same story now. Because they haven't declared their ideological opposition to girls' schooling on principle.
Why are they doing that?
I think that to give themselves more space to manoeuvre. Right now, it seems that the Taliban just want to take women out of public life as much as possible and are only willing to compromise on the edges. Even that's a very delicate local compromise or turning a blind eye as opposed to a matter of policy.
Let's hear from the horse's mouth now. Here's one official addressing the very subject of our episode.
Women. Women are not complete part of our economy. So if they will sit 50% of our population, if they will sit in home, so the next 50% will take care of them. This is our duty as a man in Islamic view that we have to take care of our women sitting in home.
Here comes the history bit from Bari, and prepare to travel back almost 100 years to find the seeds of animosity towards gender equality.
The similarities of the past are actually uncanny. If you were to hear about a moment in Afghan history, for example, where armed insurgents from the countryside rose up against their Western-inspired reforming government, surrounded and took over Kabul after a period of civil war, established an Islamic emirate, shut down girls' schools, all the while panicked Western diplomats fled from the airport in a mass evacuation, you would be really forgiven for thinking it was recap of August 2021 and the Taliban takeover of Kabul. But that is exactly what happened in October of 1928, when one of Afghanistan's first reformer governments was taken over by what was really a popular Islamic insurgency. And that reformer government was led by a king, Amanullah Khan, and a big part of his reforms are also reforms around gender for women.
He is the man himself speaking in France about education opportunities for Afghans.
He was directly inspired by the West. What he wanted to build in his mind was a functioning, independent Afghanistan that could stand shoulder to shoulder with European countries. He brought about some serious reforms in terms of prohibiting polygamy, bringing about a minimum marriage age for women, creating a specific hospital for women, and introducing a handful of girls' schools mostly confined to Kabul. These reforms triggered a mass backlash. Several tribes rose up against him, and Amanullah Khan was portrayed by these various groups as being a threat to Islam and overthrown accordingly. But I think what we can see from this sequence of events in Afghan history is how women became a proxy for the nation's image of itself.
So this Western liberal ideas with regards to women's role in society, they don't seem to have found a fertile ground in Afghanistan.
Not at that moment, no. Afghan progressives would look back on Amanullah as the great lost hopes who wanted both an independent Afghanistan and a progressive one. Whereas for more conservative Afghans, his reign became a parable warning against bringing foreign values into the country, because inevitably the people would revolt, bring back and codify much more restrictive values based on their idea of Islam. I think from that moment, it was established in the mind of more conservative, suspicious Afghans, especially in a country with a long history of foreign intervention, this connection between reforms around gender and foreign intervention.
Current generations will remember two successive foreign interventions, first by the Soviet Union in the 80s and then by the Americans.
Both of which, in different ways, were justified on the basis of wanting to develop Afghanistan and bring about a more liberal and Western-inspired gender norms. They were alien in the sense that they found purchase amongst a very, very tiny community of intellectuals, and you didn't really have the institutions or the social classes that would have been the natural basis of women advocating for their rights.
And you mentioned the other two interventions. Was there a difference in how those two campaigns for the rights of women were received in Afghanistan?
I think under the Soviets, they had, say, a firm hand over the urban areas, and in the rest of Afghanistan, what they brought was a total war. The estimate for the war was about 1 million killed. And I think in the Soviet war, what you really saw was a national uprising in response, which included leftist groups, some of which were women-led. The Soviets presenting themselves as the harbingers of social progress to Afghanistan, that really tainted those ideas for a generation for Afghans because of the extreme violence of the occupation. And so with the arrival of the Americans in 2001, a large coalition of Afghans are willing to accept an intervention as the price for removing the Taliban.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
100,000 Afghans were killed during the American occupation. The continuation of war in the countryside was still enough to alienate a large number of Afghans, aka the social base of the Taliban, and to underline that connection in Afghan history between the idea of women's rights being a fundamentally foreign imposition by foreign powers.
You are listening to The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring.
Did you know that it's 50 years this week since Richard Nixon became the first US president in history to resign from office? To mark this monumental moment, Witness History brings you 5 programs about influential events in US presidential history. And with all the amazing twists and turns in the current race for the White House, what a time to bring you them. You'll hear about the closest US election in history and from the man who was in the Situation Room during the raid on Osama bin Laden. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The last time the Taliban were in power, times were very different. It was before the internet and social media revolutionized how information traveled.
When the Taliban first came to power in the 1990s, there was only a state-run radio, which the Taliban named Voice of Shariat. But when they were ousted, the media outlets mushroomed all of a sudden because they were receiving some kind of funds from the international community and to a large extent freedom of speech as well.
The people of Afghanistan had a taste of freedom. So to bring the country back to square one required a reorder of the information space. Here are a few figures to illustrate their handiwork. According to the Afghan Independent Journalist Association, more than half of the 547 media outlets disappeared. Since the Taliban's takeover, 84% of journalists have stopped working because of the fear of repression. Those who have continued are doing so by putting their lives at risk.
The situation has totally changed, but the Taliban restriction on media was gradual. This is what the Taliban say. It is not the Taliban who have closed down these outlets, but it is because of the financial issues. But as far as we can see, both are in play. Financial issues and the Taliban restriction as well.
There's a huge censorship on media in Afghanistan, on freedom of expression. So many media outlets were closed. So many journalists and media organizations, they left Afghanistan. And also when Taliban took over, so they have banned international TV channels, including BBC Pashto TV as well. And there were reports about the detention of some journalists in Afghanistan by Taliban members.
And how has the media changed in terms of how it looks?
You can't see so many women, especially on the screen, if they want to work on the screen, so they are not allowed to show or reveal their faces. Even if you're a contributor, you have to cover.
They have ordered them to follow the gender segregation. So whenever there is a program which is run, for example, by a female presenter, the male guest should be in a separate studio. Gender segregation.
So it's like I interview you, but I have to be in a different room.
Yes,
and
yeah.
We won't be able to make eye contacts.
Yes, yeah, yeah. You are right, yes. For example, in the past, most of the programs were run by a female and a male presenter. But now part of a program is run by a female presenter and part run separately by a male presenter. And they cannot be sitting together presenting a program.
That is for the private TV stations. State TV, of course, is a completely different case.
In a state-run and Taliban-controlled National Afghanistan TV, you cannot see a woman at all. I have seen a couple of women in a health advertisement. Apart from that, no female is allowed to be on air. In terms of foreign media outlets, programs which was relayed by the local media, it all have stopped. Especially it was BBC, Radio Liberty, and Voice of America, and also Deutsche Welle TV programs produced in Pashto or Dari no longer available.
Now everything is totally changed. Movies from Bollywood, Hollywood are not allowed. Music is totally banned. So no music, no concerts, no movies, and no entertainment.
So it's just men talking.
Most of the time, yes.
What are they talking about?
Perhaps they talk about themselves, about their life, about politics.
Most of the time, the programs are on security, how the Taliban managed to ensure the security of the country. They are interviewing members of the public who express how they are happy with the security situation as well. Mostly, they are using the media outlets to promote their own narratives and comparing how better they are than the previous Western-backed government in Afghanistan.
What are the subjects they don't touch?
As far as I know and as far as I told, they don't dare to talk about women and they are not allowed to talk about women. So that's the missing part.
They cannot report when there is an armed attack inside the country, whether by Islamic State group or other armed opponents of the Taliban. They cannot report the casualties figures because they think that it is a credit for opponents and media cannot report them.
And they cannot report on the protests by women.
Some of them were reported, but they were reported in a way not to upset the Taliban. For example, they used force to disperse the protesters. The TV could not report that one. They are not allowed to film the protest. The video that they are showing is mainly filmed by mobile phones or cell phones.
Media.
Yeah, social media. Reporters are not allowed to film anti-Taliban protests.
The new rulers inherited a society where even women feel entitled to freedom.
Afghanistan had some brave women, and they went to streets and they had their protests. According to some reports, some of them were detained. And also there were some claims about torture and bad behaviors. It's a big disgrace in that society that when a female is detained, it's a big thing. It's a shame. It's a disgrace for the whole family.
There are still protests against the Taliban, but most of these protests have gone indoor in a state of streets and just raised their voices, covering their face as well, not to be recognized by the Taliban, otherwise they will be caught and imprisoned. The protest and a kind of resistance is still going on by women activists inside the country.
It's a muzzled resistance, pinning hopes on the outside world.
When you are hungry, when you don't have roof over your head, when you know that if I take a step out of my house, I know that there's a possibility that I lose my life. So in this circumstances, what will you do? And they say that this is exactly our situation, because we can't do anything. But of course, the Western world can do a lot. So they're asking for help.
Observing the situation from the outside, senior UN officials are calling for a tougher stance towards the Taliban.
The situation amounts to persecution based on gender, which is a crime against humanity within the Rome Statute. I'll go further and say that it may be characterized as gender apartheid.
Some strong language aside, the outside world seems to be torn between principles and realpolitik. Some countries have opened offices in Kabul.
The Taliban introduced their diplomats in several countries, most of the Central Asian countries, Iran as well as China, Russia, and in return, the other countries have their ambassadors and diplomats in Kabul as well. But they say that the reason behind this is not recognition, but engagement to get Afghanistan out of this isolation.
In terms of international recognition, I really do think that for many countries, questions around whether the Taliban can keep Afghanistan quiet and cracking down on ISIS and migration are much, much more important than what the Taliban do when it comes to social rights and gender rights within Afghanistan's borders. I think that's the pragmatic reality. And I think why a lot of Western governments are not keen on taking up the campaign of a gender apartheid is because it would justify the asylum application of every single Afghan woman and girl, in theory, coming to a Western country. For countries like Iran in particular, the most important issues around international recognition aren't actually, maybe not unsurprisingly, women's rights, but the Taliban establishing what they call an all-inclusive government comprised of all of Afghanistan's ethnic groups instead of just ethnic Pashtun. In a country where it's disputed but no single ethnic group can claim a majority.
Haroon explained the Taliban's chain of command and mentioned regional divisions. So how united is the group ideologically? One UN official hinted at the existence of moderate voices.
There are some critic voices among them, especially in Kabul, who are saying that women should be allowed to go to school, but their core leadership of the Taliban are against the women education. There were reports that in Kandahar, girls can go only to preliminary schools. And over grade 3, there is no school for girls in Kandahar, especially where their leader is based.
So there seems to be a division between Kabul and Kandahar.
Regarding the women education, yes. But in other affairs, to a large extent, they seem very united. they have said that they will never give in or surrender to the Western orders. And they're saying that they defeated over 40 countries in Afghanistan. And that's why they are proud and saying that the use of force produced no result. And that's why no country has leverage on them.
With the outside world being short on leverage, it's hard to see where help could come from.
History tells us that attempts by outside powers to bring about social change in Afghanistan have often backfired or worse. Usually what we've seen in terms of successful, sustainable change has come about as a result of struggle and social development that has happened on Afghan terms. But Afghans, Afghan women in particular, are stuck between an authoritarian and intransigent government and a dire economy caused by the Taliban's international isolation. And this is not to mention the deep environmental crises Afghanistan faces. It's difficult to see from here where change will come from, but one thing appears to be clear. The Taliban are here to stay.
When you have spent 3 years of your life in darkness and every day you're waiting for a light, for a change in your life, but you can't see it, it would be really difficult to have the hope for the future.
There is no hope for women. When there is uneducated women in a family, it affects the next generation. A large number of extremists will be in power in the near future, and it will be difficult for the international community to engage with them. And the Taliban are gradually implementing their own narrative or their own interpretation of Islam on the whole population. And it is the radicalization is going on smoothly and silently in the country. It is like a ticking bomb.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. Thank you to Shazia Haya, Sana Safi, Haroon Rahmani and Barry Sadid. Barry was also the producer of this episode, along with Krista Shaturi and Elchin Suleimanov. The man at the sound desk is Nigel Dix, the editor is Judy King and the presenter, Grassy Twig. And while you're still with us, we kept something for the end that you might find interesting, a window into the Taliban's thinking in the shape of an edict, read by Majid Nusrat.
Over long hair itself has no social effect other than engendering fear and horror. Today's warfare against kafirs on non-believers is conducted from a distance using long-range arms rather than face-to-face. So, long hair will not terrify the enemy. The Mujahideen are busy with their jihadi activity and the Taliban with their education, while this type of hair wastes precious time because hair requires a lot of attention and protection. Without that, they will look like drug addicts. It creates useless pride and arrogance, which is a major sin in the hereafter. Mujahideen with long hair are sometimes seen washing and combing their hair in streams, where on occasion women collect drinking water and wash clothes. As the Mujahideen are under surveillance from the enemy, it will make it easier for the spies to identify them by their long hair, thus creating a security risk for them.
Did you know that it's 50 years this week since Richard Nixon became the first US president in history to resign from office? To mark this monumental moment, Witness History brings you 5 programs about influential events in US presidential history. And with all the amazing twists and turns in the current race for the White House, what a time to bring you them. You'll hear about the closest US election in history and from the man who was in the Situation Room during the raid on Osama bin Laden. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.